I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Many people in America are challenged by low skills, low education attainment, and low pay. It's not an easy set of problems to solve, but New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg has made it a priority of his second term to reduce New York's poverty rate. Deputy Mayor Linda Gibbs is his point person for the effort, and she's with us today to tell us what New York is doing and what progress the city is making. We'll also talk to Alex Frankel, who has seen entry-level work from a rare perspective. He set out to work frontline jobs at some of America's best-known companies, including Starbucks, Whole Foods, Enterprise Car Rental, and UPS. He documented his experiences in his new book, Punching In: The Unauthorized Adventures of a Frontline Employee. We'll be back with this week's edition of Smart City right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Linda Gibbs is the Deputy Mayor for Health and Human Services in the City of New York. Prior to her appointment as Deputy Mayor, Linda was the Commissioner of the Department of Homeless Services. During the Giuliani administration, she served as the Deputy Commissioner for Management and Planning for the Administration for Children's Services. Linda, how many poor people are there in the City of New York?
We have 19% of our population living in poverty. That's above the national average of about 12%. And what that translates to in a city of 8 million is over 1.5 million people that are living below the poverty line.
How many of them work?
About half. That is the really troubling thing about the trend here in the city as well as nationally. More and more of the people who are living in poverty have an adult in the household who's worked at some point during the year. Now, the case is that most of them are working part-time. Maybe it's a seasonal job, maybe it's a part-time job, but they are working and still living below the poverty line.
Is the number of poor people in New York increasing or decreasing?
It has been pretty stable over the past 4 or 5 years. We've seen just very slight decreases in the past 2 years. And what we're really looking at is how we can pick up some of the lessons that really saw the poverty rate decline in the late 90s and translate them into the needs of the current population. We had a number of strategies in the late 90s around welfare reform and the earned income tax credit that had the effect of reducing the number of women and their children who lived in poverty. And what we're trying to really think through now is how we can translate those strategies over to other populations that are not necessarily receiving public benefits, but where a similar approach can help to induce people further into the workforce and bring more income into those households.
Well, we often hear the words making work pay, or I think you've used work must pay. Is the solution a private sector solution? Is it a public sector solution? Is it a combination of both?
I think any solution, when you talk about something that is as broad and intractable as poverty can be, has to be from all the sectors working simultaneously. Clearly, government has had a role, and traditionally that's been a safety net role. What we have tried to do over the years is to advance the way that government approaches the issue so that the interventions that are put in place actually help people to move into the workforce and to soften the transition when they are coming off of a public benefit into the labor force so that they don't actually see a drop in income. Every new dollar earned should be a benefit to the household, not have the effect of seeing other dollars from public programs be reduced. Mm-hmm. And so what you want to make sure is that you have governmental policies that work in tandem with the realities of the private sector employment so that more work and higher salaried work is always encouraged.
But it must frustrate you, as it frustrates me, that there are people working 40-hour work weeks who are still in poverty.
That's right. And we know that the minimum wage and some of the salaries that are paid to the entry-level jobs are not enough to be able to afford everything that you need to pay for in households. And that's where we really look to see how can we have government programs that can help to support the needs of individuals. And, of course, it gets back to the question of health insurance, we know that a lot of those entry-level jobs do not come with health insurance. And the cost of affording private health insurance is just prohibitive. And we don't want to be in a position where people are opting out of health insurance because they simply need to use their resources to pay the rent and pay for food. And so while we all need to continue our advocacy nationally to ensure greater coverage for all individuals in health insurance and to see more better paid jobs created in our economy, at the same time, we need to work in the short term to think about how we can bring those further supplements into the households of the working poor population.
A couple of questions you've raised for me. One, you have the unusual circumstance of having a mayor who's been wildly successful in the private sector, Mayor Michael Bloomberg. I'm wondering if you've, and I know this is relieving poverty in the city of New York is a major goal of his second administration. I'm curious if you have been able at all to think about job redesign, job restructuring in a way that a 40-hour work week pays a living wage and does not require public supports. I mean, that is, it seems to me like that may be at least part of the solution that we don't give a lot of focus to, and yet you have a mayor concerned about the problem and uniquely qualified to think about changes in the public sector. And I'm not talking about increases in minimum wage. I'm really talking about redesigning jobs that create more value and therefore command higher pay.
Well, one of the most interesting things that the mayor did early in his tenure was to take our employment services and to embed them within our small business development agency. What we had before that was a separation of those two functions, and the employment agency would spend a lot of time trying to provide training services to individuals in hopes that they, that are skilled, would then go off and find those higher paying jobs. Now, by putting these two functions together in one agency, you actually can think about where is the growth potential in the city? Where are those new jobs, those better paying jobs, potentially going to be, and how can we use our employment dollars in a way that both helps individuals get trained for those higher paying jobs, but also sends a strong message out to the local employers. These are the types of jobs and opportunities that we value. We're going to invest our city dollars to help you develop a skilled workforce, and at the same time, we're sending that signal that we expect the jobs that are provided in the economy to be high quality jobs that can afford people the chance for independent self-sufficiency. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the city is a huge procurer of services. We have not only in our direct employment of those who the city pays their salaries, but through our contracted services, we support the livelihoods of hundreds of thousands of individuals. And we also have been looking at our contracted services to understand how we structure the requirements of those contracts so that those employers are similarly incentivized to bring on a skilled professional workforce with living wage employment backing up those contracts.
I want to come back to, I guess, an obvious question. Most of us think of housing prices in New York as exorbitant, unaffordable. So how is it that so many poor people manage to live in New York?
We do, in fact, have generous programs. We have generous safety net programs that provide rental assistance, food assistance, a whole range of supports. And what we have been focused on is making sure that those programs don't encourage dependency, but are continuously being structured in a way that rewards and incentivizes all of the workforce participation that we want people to be engaged in, so that they're actually, it helps to bring them on a path toward economic independence. And at the same time, we know that we have a number of people who are not making ends meet, and we really try to invest in community-based prevention programs as a way of trying to help people get through a crisis moment without falling into harder times, for perhaps needing homeless shelter or needing sustained public assistance because they cannot find employment that can hold them for the longer time. And so those partnering with our community-based organizations, again, everybody being focused on what the long-term employment growth opportunities in the community are, will really try to intervene in the households before the crisis becomes one that ends up in homelessness or joblessness.
Mm-hmm. You say you have 1.5 million poor people in the city of New York. What percent of those people do you think have the ability to significantly increase their incomes through work?
The adults in the households are about half of those individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And for, not every person who lives in poverty has the same experience. Some of them are going to move through poverty. It's an episode in their life, and it's not going to be a long-term or intergenerational thing. For those where we know poverty is handed down from generation to generation, is really more the focus of our very intensive efforts. And that's where we're trying to tailor programs that really recognize the life experience that people have. So, for instance, if an individual has a history of incarceration, that can create really tremendous barriers to future employment. And so we have structured very specific programs that help to give them transitional support while they are in that first job, and an opportunity to develop a resume and demonstrate to a private sector employer that they really have straightened themselves out and that they are a dependable employee who shows up on time over a long period of time. And so you have a structured response that really that is taking into account that life history. Similarly, we have over 200,000 young people between ages 16 and 24 that right now are not in work or in school. And what we need to do is to create programs that reaches out at the street level in the communities where those young people are and brings them in and engages them in an activity as the first step toward moving them toward getting their degrees and retaining that longer-term employment. And so those programs are really quite different. And it really gets to the complexity of tackling these issues, and in many regards why some of the most interesting things do come from local governments, because you have to tailor it to the specifics of the population who are suffering in your community and understand those underlying issues in order to intervene in a way that can break that cycle.
But that's a huge organizational challenge, to say nothing of what is it you do, just thinking of how you organize to do it for 1.5 million poor people is pretty overwhelming. Do you deliver those services directly as the City of New York, or do you contract with community-based organizations?
Well, and this is one of the greatest things about the mayor's anti-poverty strategies. It involves some 10 to 12 city agencies, each having an expertise in a different facet of the work, and each of them in turn contract with community-based organizations who partner with the agency employees in implementing the program. The other thing that the mayor's approach has embraced is the need to evaluate all of these programs really closely. We have so many different ideas that are building on a record of experience of programs, but really a weakness in providing evaluation and outcome data to show how successful they are. We're very committed with this initiative that we're undertaking. We're investing $150 million in programs that are being designed to meet the needs of these different populations through this whole variety of partners. But what we want to do is document what works and what doesn't work. And the mayor is very clear. The dollars will be there for the programs that work, but those that can't produce results will not have their funding continued. We really need to be very targeted and smart about how to make these interventions succeed, and if they don't succeed, we need to have really the bravery to say it's not working and we shouldn't continue to fund it.
And, of course, on a problem that is sometimes as intractable as poverty, that's a tough thing to do. I'm curious, what's the time frame? I mean, in what time frame do you need to see results? Does he need to see results?
And some of these things can take years before you'll really know. So, for instance, with a 16-year-old who's dropped out of school, it's going to be a long time before you know whether they can sustain themselves independently as an adult. But what we can look to in the short term is just some immediate outcomes. How many of these young people even graduate from the program? As you can imagine, with these disconnected youth, they often won't even stay in a program for more than a couple of weeks or a month. And so some short-term success is seeing how many people can actually stay in programs, be graduated from programs. And for many of these that are 3 or 6 month programs, the outcome that we're measuring is whether they are placed into a job and then how long they keep those jobs. And so in 3 or 6 months, we'll see both how many graduate and how many are achieve the job placement. So you look at those short-term outcomes as the sign of what will result later. And what we ultimately will want to do is track them over years to find out, well, do they stay in the labor market? Do they stay in entry-level positions that don't pay good wages, or do they actually progress onto the next job and start to move into those livable wage positions? Those things, you have to have the patience and you have to stay committed to tracking the outcomes if you're going to know ultimately over the long term if they're successful in breaking the cycle of poverty.
It may be impossible to generalize, but I'm going to ask you to try. Is the problem, is the barrier to gaining employment a function of skills, lack of habits, or problems with the resume, if you will, a felony on your record, et cetera?
I think it's many things. It's not none of these things are one simple quick fix. And I think what we've been trying to do is to both think structurally in the city. How have we used our employment, workforce development resources? How have we invested those dollars, and have we invested in them in the smartest way that helps build the opportunities in the growth sectors that provide the best jobs? And how can we do a better job at that on a systemic level? And then on an individual level, many people will be brought along in the tide of the benefit of that approach without any further help. But we do know that a lot of individuals have barriers beyond what's going on in the economy, and they are going to remain excluded from opportunities without further help. And that's where you try to come in and make sure that you have created opportunities for those disconnected populations or those who will experience some form of discrimination in the workforce, and help to both engage them in a way that allows them to really act on their hopes and their dreams, and that also helps to demonstrate to employers that they are individuals who are committed and ready and reliable and very eager to participate in all the opportunities that are available.
As a result of the Commission on Economic Opportunity that you now lead reports to you, you identified certain segments of poor people where you believed your efforts were more likely to pay off. Who were they?
Well, part of the thing we did in preparing the recommendations with the commission was looked at the research. You know, what do we know that's out there that works? We know, now this is one that you really have to wait a long term for the payoff, but we know investment in early childhood education works. If you can help a child enter kindergarten ready to learn, those investments in the early years from 0 to 5 will pay off throughout that child's life. And you know, we have to be smart as a society to be willing to make those investments up front. And the flip side, and I will, you know, be frank about this, there is not a lot of research that demonstrates what works with the disconnected youth. There is some people would advise, you know, gee, they're, you know, the opportunity is already passed for them, and we don't have a lot that works, so, you know, put your money elsewhere. To the commission and to this mayor, that was an unacceptable answer. We have 200,000 young people who right now are not engaged, and what we need to do with that group is to try new approaches, to be willing to take some risks and be innovative, but back it up with the kind of research that will demonstrate if any of these new approaches, in fact, have an impact where others haven't. And so more experimentation there, and a willingness to take a risk because it's too important a group to pass up.
Are there other segments that you've targeted?
The third major group that we targeted is the those who are working and still poor. From 1995, about 29% of those who were poor in the city were working, and by 2005, that number had grown to 46%. So it's almost half, and it is describing more and more of the people who were poor in our country. And there, it's also more promising because we do know a lot about how some of these incentives impact employment. And back to the expansion of the earned income tax credit for adults with who are raising children, there was a really dramatic expansion in that program in the mid-90s. And it is credited for about half of the poverty reduction we saw in the households of primarily women with young children. And so that leaves us really the opportunity to say, well, if we would extend this generous benefit to individuals who do not have children, and that's typically these young men who are on their own, mm-hmm. and if they are not, if they're not residing with their children, we know that they are the fathers to the children, and with increased earnings can bring that money into the house of their child and reduce their children's poverty even further. And so if we do things like consider expansions of the EITC for the childless adults, that could have the impact of bringing more individuals deeper into the labor market, deeper into their earning potential, and support the children that are now being raised without the benefit of their father's income.
Mm-hmm. New York has taken inspiration from an opportunities program in Mexico and has launched a controversial program to pay poor people for good behavior. Tell me how the program works and why you think it's a good idea.
Well, this is actually a very exciting one, and the idea of conditional cash transfers that we came upon when we were doing our research, at first we really didn't think it was going to be relevant for us. It exists in about 20 countries. It started about 10 years ago in Mexico, and most of the countries that it exists in are poor countries. And for that reason, we thought that it wouldn't really be a transferable program to our economy. But as we looked at it, we thought the issues are very much the same, that the issues of poverty are often related to poor education and poor health. And if we invest more in the human capital of our households in poor communities through incentivizing the kind of activities that we know are related to later reductions in poverty, by incentivizing high attendance at school, by incentivizing getting good grades on standardized tests, by incentivizing going to a primary health care visit and paying people for accomplishing a set of activities, will that have the effect of seeing reductions in poverty in these households both immediately because it's transferring the cash into the household for successful completion of the activities, but more importantly, over the long term, by having a sustained impact on how the household's health and education improves and how that later contributes to improved earnings potential?
Linda Gibbs is Deputy Mayor for Health and Human Services in the City of New York. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planeta's and assistant editor, Nate Berg.
What may be the country's least anticipated ranking has just been announced, and with it has come a flood of criticisms and attacks. Released this week was the 14th annual City Crime Rankings, more commonly recognized as the listing of the, quote, most dangerous cities in America. As could be expected, representatives from the cities high up on the list are not too thrilled to be there. But they're more unhappy about the fact that the list was created in the first place. Detroit, Michigan is ranked as the country's most dangerous city this year, reclaiming the title from last year's dishonoree, St. Louis, Missouri. CNN reports that Detroit police have released a statement blasting the ranking for using crime statistics out of context. The American Society of Criminology agrees, calling the list an irresponsible misuse of the FBI's crime data on such crimes as burglary, theft, robbery, aggravated assault, rape, and homicide. The FBI is also on the offensive against the ranking, which it says does not take into account the major differences between cities and their social situations. Meanwhile, in California, the state attorney general is considering a plan that would make it a crime to ignore the environment when cities make and approve plans. Attorney General Jerry Brown is on a path to ensure that the threats of climate change are considered and accounted for as cities and counties plan their land use. If they don't, he says, lawsuits will follow, arguing that municipalities are not complying with the California Environmental Quality Act. The Oakland Tribune reports that Brown is serious about this issue, as he has already sued one California county for not including the consideration of greenhouse gas emissions in its general plan update. No further lawsuits have been filed, but Brown says that if the climate continues to be ignored, somebody's getting sued. And finally, in downtowns across the country, cities are employing a method to help revitalize the areas and help them to become more economically sustainable. They are doing this by what some are calling business incubation, where cities use tax incentives and other methods to lure in new businesses to their downtowns. The target businesses are typically small entrepreneurial efforts, and the cities make available to them small office spaces with cheap rents, according to the New Jersey Herald, where business incubation is taking off in the small town of Newton. The idea behind it is that by making the downtown attractive and affordable to small businesses, they will stick around after they get on their feet and find some success. Though the project has just begun, many are expecting Newton, New Jersey to be the next successful business incubator. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll talk to Alex Frankel about his experiences as a frontline employee at some of America's best-known companies. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Alex Frankel is author of Punching In, The Unauthorized Adventures of a Frontline Employee. Alex is a San Francisco-based writer who has written about business culture and adventure for Wired, Fast Company, The New York Times Magazine, and Outside. Alex, I love your idea for this book. Where did the idea originate?
The idea first came to me when years ago I met somebody who worked as a seasonal assistant driver for UPS, and he described to me his job and the level to which the company studied his actions in the field to make him a better worker. And that set an idea in my head. And as I became a business journalist years later, I always thought about that person I'd met and wanted to become that face of the company as he had been.
At UPS, you did work for UPS. You were given little training in how to treat customers, which surprised me, and yet it seemed to surprise you too. And yet UPS has such a strong corporate culture that employees, that is the ones who make it to day five, absorb the culture and then develop a great esprit de corps. How does the corporate culture get transmitted to the frontline worker?
Well, in my case, I didn't receive much training, largely because I was a seasonal helper just there for the month of December. So I was a little bit atypical. But typically what you see is at a place like UPS, the corporate culture really is something that goes from one employee to the next. It's something you feel when you're talking to your colleagues. And you'll receive ideas and different sensibilities from the managers you work with. But it depends on the company. Some companies are much more formulaic and have written down notes and documents that employees will read, and that will shape how they understand the corporate culture that they're joining.
How would you describe the UPS culture as it relates to the frontline worker?
The frontline worker at UPS, from my experience, it felt as if it was somewhat militaristic in the most positive sense, in that there was, like you said, an esprit de corps or a feeling as if you were part of a tight team of people who were focused on delivering packages, literally, but also delivering a promise to their customers. And that there, you know, there's a lot of pressure in that job. And so that also galvanizes the corporate culture there, too.
You thought about quitting UPS after 4 days, which apparently is not unusual.
Right. Some of the research I did later confirmed that I was not abnormal, but there's so many demands of you as a worker there on the front lines when you start that it can be depressing, or you feel like maybe it's not the best place for you. And in my case, after that fourth day, I pushed through and it was very much worth it, rewarding. For me, it was akin to going from the outside, feeling like I wasn't meant to be there, to then feeling like I was. And I think that transition is probably fairly common for people who work there.
And can you explain, I mean, that's every employer's dream, to make the employee thinking about quitting go from feeling like an outsider to an insider. Can you explain at all how that happened, what happened to create that feeling?
Sure. Well, in my case, at UPS, the feeling of transition came about when I felt tired, exhausted, and just not committed to the job. And somehow on the fifth day I was there working with another driver, I was his assistant for the day, and between the two of us, a teamwork developed, and he trusted that I was helping him, and I felt good that I was, you know, a strong part of the chain we were in, the team. And then I went from feeling I want to leave to feeling that if I did, I'd be letting the people around me down. And it was sort of an ineffable feeling that happened throughout the day. But indeed, that would be most employers' dream, to have people make that switch early on in their job.
You admit that you attempted to game the job applicant test at Whole Foods and Home Depot and elsewhere. You tried to hide your true nature to make yourself seem more suited to a frontline job. What did you believe would make you more suited to such a job?
Well, what I didn't really understand the big picture early on, and that is that although as a customer you may think that Whole Foods and Home Depot are largely looking to hire people from the same talent pool, they really aren't. They're looking, the best of these companies are trying to isolate people who would be the best suited to work there. And so in my case, my genuine character traits that would make me a good employee were found their home at a place like UPS, but other places, say Whole Foods, where I did not get a job, they're looking for people who are much more people oriented, or want to be offering great customer service. And that is, you know, I have some skills that are valuable on the front lines at these companies and others that aren't. And through the online questionnaires and other interviews at some companies, they were able to determine that. And I have to give them credit for that.
Did you find all companies that you, and let's be specific, you were really trying to get jobs at companies that are recognized as being better than average, have better than average brand names. Many of them are noted for their hiring practices and their pay and their benefits. And so you were trying to work at employers who were essentially a cut above. Fair statement?
Absolutely. I made a list of about 30 companies that I'd seen, you know, come up in the business press or in case studies taught in business schools, and also places where I, as a customer, had shopped or been in, and recognized that their people were not offering standard service, but something a little better. And typically, these places pay a little higher than other low-wage jobs. So there, I made a pretty loose grouping. And then it came to the companies and applying there and seeing who would hire me.
And some companies, as you said, wouldn't hire you. Whole Foods didn't hire you. I thought it was interesting you got rejected by the Container Store.
Right.
Does that make you resent the Container Store?
No, on the contrary. I left The Container Store was one of the early companies I applied for, and I got an interview, went in, and now what's common is a so-called group interview where up to 10 or more people who have made that first cut sit in a group and get interviewed together. And it's an interesting format. And for me, being an undercover reporter, I got to see the other applicants who had made it to that level. And I realized at that stage that I wasn't in the top two people. You know, I wasn't of the top of my group there. So if I had been hiring the group, I wouldn't have hired me. And so I left inspired by their process. And the actual interview was extremely creative and very different than others I went to.
What made it creative and different?
Well, the chief exercise we did as a group was at some point casually halfway through the couple hour interview, one of the interviewers sent us off into the store, and the interview was being held right in the middle of the store, which was already different. So we all went out and picked a couple of products that we then brought back to the group and then shared why we brought them back and what we thought of them. And there you really saw the different people shine or not shine based on their level of passion for these products. And I was in the class of people who just didn't show that much interest in the thing I brought back. And that separated the best applicants from the weaker ones, I thought.
Have you gone back into a container store since your interview and had customer service that you think is clearly a reflection of the interviewing and hiring process?
Absolutely. Yeah, I've been back, and I actually wrote about this in the book that I wrote, which was I was in another store at one point next door to a container store that sold similar products, and a fellow told me I could find the same product next door at the container store for a lower price. And then I followed up that lead a couple minutes later and went in, and sure enough, this guy who told me to go over was a store employee, and he had been on his break just browsing at the neighboring store. And when I went back, there he was in his uniform, and it was clear that this guy wasn't faking it. He had gone next door because he really cared about products and wanted to see the prices and what they were doing and how they were displaying them. And that's the kind of thing which I think you see a lot at a place like the Container Store.
You say that different companies are looking for different profiles in their frontline employees, but after working a number of these jobs, is there any – can you generalize in any way about the skills and the habits and the personality traits that make a good frontline employee?
Sure. There are some general skills, although I need to be clear that one of the distinguishing characteristics of these best – frontline company or hiring companies that hire frontline employees is that they do match the people to their cultures. And general skills, these folks who work there really are interested in the products being sold or the services offered and genuinely want to help the people who come in. Once you have a divide there between the customers and the employees, it's very difficult for a company to survive.
You worked for Enterprise, a car rental company that has provided me with unfailingly excellent customer service. I can't say enough good things about my experience with Enterprise. What is the secret to that company's customer service?
I would say it comes from a number of angles. Number one is the people they're attracting are very eager, young, recent college graduates who, for the most part, believe in the company as not just a hourly job, which it is at the first level, but as a career choice and as a way to learn skills which will help them in business, which it often does for them, even if they don't last at the company. Also, like a lot of these other frontline workplaces, the company enterprise, they use a very serious feedback loop to determine how each branch is doing and how the customers are responding. And using that feedback loop allows the corporation, you know, the outside, the headquarters, to keep an eye on the branches and to not let them go astray from the main mission.
One of the things that's always surprised me about enterprise is that you clearly have a different quality counterperson, shall I say, but it's also like the guys in the back, the guys handling the cars, bringing the cars around, getting you the keys, that are extraordinary. Like, would you like a bottle of water? And I mean, they just couldn't be nicer. Do they too see enterprise as a career, as a way to learn business skills?
Well, you know, I'm not sure who you encountered, but most branches are run and as if everybody there is trying to work their way up to the next level in terms of gaining more responsibilities. And most of the people you'll encounter are so-called management trainees, and they have been brought in and trained for a week off-site and are starting out at the bottom level. They may be washing cars, picking you up, doing everything, and their sights are often set on managing that branch or another branch.
What should other companies learn from enterprise?
I think other companies who don't have these feedback loops should think about incorporating them. At enterprise, it's a little extreme, the level to which they control how the success of each branch. However, there are upsides. So I think other companies, you know, that may lose track of their off-site or different branches should keep an eye on them better.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Alex Frankel. He's the author of Punching In, The Unauthorized Adventures of a Frontline Employee. Alex, you worked for two of the best-known brands in America, The Gap and Starbucks. Contrast your experiences at those two companies.
Sure. The experience I had at Starbucks was one in which there was never any downtime. The store I worked at was extremely busy. At the same time, if you were not working behind the register or making coffee drinks, you were cleaning the store or restocking. So there was always something to do. It was an extremely efficient system in which you felt like you were part of a tight chain. If you weren't doing your job very well, you would let that your team down. On the flip side, I found Gap to be not as organized or efficient in terms of what we as employees were doing. It's a very different focus for what a low-level employee at Gap in a Gap store is doing. I found myself often wandering around without much to do, charged with basically keeping the store looking neat by folding clothes, you know, often up to 300 garments per day.
If you were in charge of job training for low-skilled workers in America, something that is really tough and doesn't work very well, what skills and habits would you work on, knowing that there is huge potential in terms of jobs available for frontline employees and you know, fast-growing service businesses? What are the skills and habits you would try to develop in low-skilled workers?
I think without being too general, the idea of involving some sort of learning or education in a job is key. If you're not learning anything or moving ahead in your job, it's very it can become very boring and not interesting. However, if there's some amount of learning or specialization that you can gain at that job, it becomes a very different workplace. So at a place like Gap, even if you have the opportunity, you can become a specialist in the jeans or the woven clothing, you know, and shirts and khakis, and really get to know that one line. And then you then have more responsibilities and can inspire and teach other employees.
We talked earlier to New York City Deputy Mayor Linda Gibbs about the number of poor people in New York who work. 46% of poor people in New York work, and a third of them are working full time. And it's occurred to me that if we could redesign jobs so that they add more value to the company, then the company could afford to pay more money, so that if you're working a 40-hour week, you're making a living wage because the job you're doing is more valuable. In your experience with all these frontline jobs, did you ever think about how the jobs could in fact be redesigned so that they could command higher wages because they were providing more value? Did you see anything that would point you in the direction of some promising ideas there?
Possibly. The one thought was that the frontline employee is someone who very much sees what a customer many customers want in a company. And that insight that they may have is often left on the table. Companies such as Starbucks or Gap or any of these where I work doesn't really tap these people who work on the front lines for much of their knowledge and insight to see what's going on. So, you know, if they were able to better communicate with the corporate headquarters, they may be able to add value to a given company. And then, like you said, the company could reward them. But beyond that, you know, I wasn't that focused on that idea.
Mm-hmm. And yet you say working at Starbucks felt very efficient, like employees were, they were getting every spare minute out of you. And of course, Starbucks has a higher pay model for its frontline workers.
Indeed. Well, all the jobs where I worked are generally higher paying than other service jobs, and that is because they're looking for they have the luxury, in a sense, of looking for people who are typically a bit more interested in what they're doing and passionate, ideally, in the given service or product they're selling. I started the project thinking that all the companies where I would end up working would be equally interesting or not interesting to me. And at the end of the project, I learned that there are indeed certain character traits that we all have that make or break a given job. And for me, I felt like when I was delivering a package to somebody's house or business, I was doing something that felt to me quite worthwhile.
Alex Frankel is author of Punching In: The Unauthorized Adventures of a Frontline Employee. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith shares a lesson about human nature learned from a decidedly non-human teacher.
The day my wife and I were there on a tour, the Sea Turtle Rescue Center at the South Carolina State Aquarium in Charleston was caring for 5 turtles, 3 loggerheads and 2 Kemp's Ridleys. They had been injured in various ways, but mostly by being caught in fishing lines or nets. These turtles had suffered lost fins, shell punctures, and other physical injuries, along with the resulting infections and trauma. The center was nursing them back to health, preparing them for an eventual return to the sea. These sea turtles, save one that was just too sick, were full of personality. One even amused itself by ambushing unsuspecting visitors with a spray of water through its snout. Several of us were reaching for towels to dry ourselves off. These turtles were clearly sentient beings, aware of us and their surroundings, and coping with their situations in the best ways they could. But they needed help, and that's exactly what they were getting. It struck me, though, that if I found myself injured and in trouble at sea, no matter how much these sea turtles might be aware of my situation, they would not be able to rescue me or restore me to health. They would be able to recognize my distress, but they wouldn't be able to relieve it. Maybe it was just the moment standing there in the midst of so much technology and so many people devoted to the well-being of these injured sea turtles. But this asymmetry between humans and sea turtles and other creatures struck me as something noteworthy. After all, we often excuse many of our worst excesses by saying that it is just in our nature, which is to say that there are certain things we can't be responsible for because they are part of our animal nature, inbred, instinctive, and inescapable. When we get angry or territorial, when we fight or engage in conflicts, when we are selfish, unmindful of others, and greedy, it's easy to chalk it up to the primitive parts of our brains and forget about it. But standing there in the Sea Turtle Rescue Center, what struck me was how different we are than that. Many animals can do some of the things we do. They use tools, they communicate, they have societies and social hierarchies, they experience emotions and display their love for others, and, of course, they fight, get angry, and are territorial. But with only the very rare exception, they don't rescue and rehabilitate other species of animals. Only humans do that. So there is something in our nature that is not animal instinct, and it is the best part of us. It is our willingness to make sacrifices to save others and other animals. Only we can do this. Animals can't rescue us or any other creatures. There is more to our nature than belligerence and aggression. Indeed, caring for others is an ordinary part of our nature, not something extraordinary. We are most special when we are at our most prosaic. We don't need to reach far to reach the stars. We only need to be ourselves. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his new book is Generation Ageless. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.